Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Charlie Ebinger. I'm the director of the Energy Security Initiative here at Brookings, and I'm delighted to collaborate with my cohorts in the Latin American Initiative. This is particularly interesting for me because my first job in the U.S. government 37 years ago, I hate to say, was as the Caribbean and Latin American desk officer and the Federal Energy Administration. So I have kept an active interest in the region for many, many years. This is a particularly interesting time, I think, for the Caribbean and the broader Latin American region because we have some very exciting developments going on with the widening of the Panama Canal to be completed in just a few years. We are going to see the possibility of a whole new trade in liquefied natural gas coming through the canal, since the canal will then be big enough to take the biggest LNG tankers in the world. And this is particularly significant at a time where the United States is discovering so much gas and that the issue of whether the U.S. could become a gas exporter looms on the horizon. And clearly, with the energy situation in Mexico and the rest of Central America being what it is, the prospect of natural gas being available to help fuel the economic development of the region, I think, is very important. And we also have some very exciting developments that will be important for Central America with some recent, very significant oil discoveries off Suriname and French Guiana. Our last panelists urged us to look elsewhere, and with the possibility of Brazil emerging as still a larger energy giant in world commerce, and now the belief that Argentina may have some of the largest natural gas, shale gas reserves in the world, this opens up still other supply patterns for Central America and Mexico, and ties in very nicely, I think, to our last panel, where we were talking about the prospects of port developments in the region to take advantage of these. And of course, we have Colombia always on the list of people that may have much higher both potential for the export of oil as well as coal. So with that introduction, I'm delighted that we have such a distinguished panel today. We have people who span not only the energy spectrum, but the economic development spectrum and international organization experience, government experience. So I think it's a wide array of diversity of backgrounds. I won't read their backgrounds since you have them in the interest of time. But let me begin by asking Johanna Mendelson Forum to start off our panel.
Inviting me to join you here today. And of course, it's always great to be on a panel with my friend Alvaro and Charles and a new friend. I'm going to talk about energy security, and Dr. Zamora gave me a pretty good outline of what he wanted said. I don't know if I'll fulfill it, but I hope you will excuse my sort of light a touch with comparing Central America to the movie Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and I include Belize in Central America for with due respect to my Guatemalan friends. I began to think about this problem of what we meant by energy security. Is it okay? Yeah. Okay. I'm getting some technical help here. But in thinking about energy security, I thought about, and you'll have to allow me this, that the movie Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, first when I talked about it to my son, he said, "Mom, nobody's going to understand what you say if they're under 40. So I have to admit that I'm past that age. So for those of you under 40 in the audience who never saw the movie or only saw it probably when you had a couple of beers in a frat house, it's a movie about seven brothers in search of seven brides. One brother gets married. I actually saw it in Andorra in the little principality in about 1966, and it was the only movie playing, so that was what our choice was. But it's a funny movie about the relationship between men and women in the West and dowries. But it made me think, as I was looking at the situation in Central America, that actually, you know, we had seven countries, no fossil fuels. Of course, Guatemala has a little bit of fossil fuels. And as Charles just said, there's a potential, but it's not there. Abundant renewable energy resources and increased need for energy that will go beyond oil. So here are the brothers, Belize, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama. And, yes, they did look like that in the 60s. And here are the brides who all have dowries. And I thought of the dowries because I'm a colonial Latin American historian to start, and dowries were very important in economic history. They are as hydro and geothermal and wind, and there's biomass, ethanol and biodiesel and tidal, and God knows what other things will be discovered. I know algae, of course, is one potential. We could go on with the list of second-generation biofuels, but we're not there yet. But I did look at the situation because of the dark side of Central America, which is that they don't have energy resources. They do have energy resources. And I think the challenge, and we heard this in the first panel, is really how do you get the coordination of governance, the right rules, the right investment climate for the private sector, so that these dowries, these well-endowed brides, can become spouses to these wonderful countries that have a tremendous potential to provide energy security for their citizens in the future. So these are some of the things that we know, and you know them as well, and I hate PowerPoints. I work with the military all the time, but please forgive me. Energy demand is going to increase by about 30% in the next two decades in the region. We know that energy poverty has to be eradicated, and Central America, unfortunately, has some of the least accessible energy opportunities in the rural area for its citizens. We need to renew the investment in renewable energy sector. There was a big boom in about 2006 and 2007 when everybody was looking to Central America as a place to go forward on. It, like other regions of the world, have been victims of the financial crisis. And also, I think the lagging of the really projected technology, which unfortunately hasn't come online as quickly as everybody had anticipated. And then we just heard about energy integration, but we can't underestimate it because it's all underway. It's very positive. We heard the great presentations about CEPAC and the energy market. But it's going to take the harmonization of regulations, as our previous panelists just discussed, and it's going to take an integrated strategy to address the demand over the next 30 years. And unfortunately, we're only at the very early stages of this, but fortunately, we're thinking about it. So I want to go through these issues because I only have 10 minutes and I have a very tough timekeeper. But these are the things I like to use seeds, and these are the challenges. And I go through, I'm sorry, I like movies and I like letters. But capital, the investment climate, connectivity, COFTA-DR, which I don't think many people mentioned, and we have a particularly fascinating issue coming up as the ethanol tariff and import tax end at the end of this month, 30 days and counting for the Brazilians in the room. Chavez, whose Petrocaribe is looking at its siren song as his health deteriorates, and Venezuela's capacity to produce oil continues to decline. We have the climate issues, and today as we speak in the other part of the world, in South Africa, they're discussing climate issues, which are affecting not only the carbon output, which I have below, but also affect sea level rises and land clearance and urbanization issues, and of course carbon. And I wanted just to address carbon for a minute, because while Costa Rica, which deserves the great award for having reached such a good level of low carbon production, and also the fact that it's made 2021 its year to be completely carbon neutral, which is a great thing. In fact, most of Latin America comes well below the carbon numbers, but that's because of the dependency on hydropower. It is, of course, renewable energy, which is increasing in the portfolio, but it's hydro. And you can't not talk about climate without carbon because, for example, in El Salvador recently, drought was one of the reasons why the country had to go back and use more geothermal energy from oil because of the vagaries of climate, the drought that reduced the hydro output for part of the year. And so it's not a guaranteed sustainable renewable energy aid the way some of these other sources are. So let's go through a few of these. I did one thing. I did put the wonderful CEPAC, and for CEPAC, that is a great graphic you have on your website. I borrowed it from you to show what the connectivity looks like and the future of that. I think that will help a great deal. But the governance issues, as I mentioned, in the connectivity are still a great problem. We still have many state-owned energy companies. The regulatory environment is yet not very conducive to a lot of large-scale investment because of the way the rules of the game are made. But I think in every country, and I went through, if you are not familiar with the REAP reports for the renewable energy reports, there is great progress. Between 2005 and today, there has been a lot of interesting and good efforts in all of these countries to expand the regulatory bodies, to create renewable energy laws, laws that in many ways were modeled after the Brazilian law, but all create great tax incentives for companies wanting to invest in renewables, with anywhere between 10 and 25 years, you pick the country, exemptions in order to create projects. So there is a good news story coming out of Central America. And yesterday when I was at a meeting with former ambassadors of Latin American countries, and they said, all you talk about in the United States are drugs and thugs, yet, and a crime. Sure, there's a security crisis. It does impact investment. But the other good news story is that you have a region of the world that could become a major energy powerhouse for Central America and also its proximity to U.S. markets. I just wanted to go this way. Is it not? The battery went dead on it. All right. Well, do it the old-fashioned way, no? It's dead. It said it's dead. Yeah, it said low battery before. When they say that on a Kensington, they mean it. Okay. I just wanted to point out the energy matrices of these different countries, mainly to demonstrate, and I apologize for the lack of similar colors. I had two interns do the slides. Geothermal, it depends what you talk about, but petroleum, which is the largest portion in many of these charts, really indicates how much of the energy is still being generated by imported oil. So Guatemala, which is a member of Petrocaribe, gets its oil on a concessional basis. It is still using it in spite of the potential for a high use of geothermal, which it has, and also for hydro energy, not to mention that Guatemala is one of the largest in the region that produces biodiesel, and it's actually one of the success stories. But as far as other biomass energy, it is only really generating the energy from the burning of bagasse to co-generate electricity. El Salvador, similar situation, lots of petroleum being used, again, in addition to all the environmental impacts. The cost of oil, as the costs continue to rise, and we'll never see $40 a barrel oil again, is going to continue to take its toll on a population that does not have a lot of money for this kind of expense and is probably soon going to lose the Petrocaribe benefits as well. Honduras, similar picture. I put those three countries have the most dependency on oil right now. You can see this. Nicaragua, same problem. Lots of oil being used, despite the fact that there's plentiful resources. Costa Rica, of course, has a large hydro portfolio, lots of other different excellent types of sources of energy. But still, there is a use of petroleum, mainly for transport in some geothermal. But it's, once again, needs to be moved ahead as well. But Costa Rica certainly has the cleanest portfolio in the region. And Panama, which, once again, it's the light blue, sorry for the color problems, that shows that how much dependency it has on petroleum. And then I wanted you to know, for all my Latin America friends, that Seven Brides and Seven Brothers was shown in Spanish, so there was a poster from that, and I will leave that up, only because I found it very charming, and so there's no excuse if you have not seen the movie to try and now think of it in terms of energy. But let me just go through a few other points, because I have about 2 minutes left. I see that two-minute signal. I mentioned a couple of other pieces. CAFTA-DR. The CAFTA was a great benefit for Central American countries, not for producing renewable energy, but for reprocessing Brazilian and other sources of ethanol. The challenge will now be with the tariff ending, what this will mean to the Central American and Caribbean industry, because they won't have to use a central base in Central America to get that tariff benefit. CAFTA allows for renewable energy in the form of ethanol coming into the United States up to 7% of the total volume, I think, to be entered into the United States duty-free. So it was really a backdoor way to get rid of the tariff. But with the tariff removed, I think it's unclear what will happen after December, and I would be very interested to hear Dr. Amanya, for example, comment on what that means. On Chavez, I'm a political scientist. I have to mention that Petrocaribe, which was, it looked very good when oil prices were very high. It certainly has been a lifeline to the government of Cuba. It has created great concessional loans for the purchase of oil at below market rates, and has allowed many countries not only to use it but to sell it on the open market and gain money, is not a sustainable way to get your energy supply. And in many ways, it inhibited the investment in other renewable areas to the detriment of those countries. So as we see possibly a passing of a Chavez era and a change in government, we don't know what will happen in Venezuela, but the guarantee of the oil coming out of that system must be taken into the governance equation and the energy equation in the region. And U.S. policy and what it will mean. I think one of the sad parts of the economic crisis has been a less than focused attention on Central America beyond the security issues in the region. We had, under the Bush administration, a rather robust effort in the U.S.-Brazil partnership to also work in Central America. Some of the countries were part of that partnership. Those countries came under another program, ECPA, but there was no resources of sorts put behind that. I would hope, as Secretary Fernandez comes this afternoon, that we might want to ask why we can't see a little bit more robust interest in a region that is so close to the United States, such an important market, and really deserves greater attention, at least to help private investment in the region, and also technical assistance, which I think the U.S. and our multilateral banks do very well, to create some of the regulatory frameworks that are needed to propose that. And finally, in conclusion, since the seven brides but seven brothers are my theme, I think we will not have a misalliance. We will have and more than a marriage of convenience, I think we'll have a very happy relationship down the road as energy demand comes forward and gets increases, because these sources are for the taking for investors, and we will see, and I think in the future, a very positive picture of how these renewable resources can complement what is already a region that is moving towards a more carbon neutral environment. So thank you, and I'll be happy to take your questions.
Very good. Very good. Our next speaker is Dr. Alvaro Humana, who has a very distinguished background as the first energy and environmental minister of Costa Rica between 1986 and 90. And as you see, the rest of his credentials, both academic and otherwise, we are indeed delighted to have him come to the podium.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you, especially on this December 1st, when 63 years ago, President Figueres of Costa Rica took the historic decision to abolish the army and set Costa Rica on a different course than the rest of our Central American and many Latin American countries. And also 2 years ago, on December 1st, we also announced our will to attempt to become, or our aspiration to try to become carbon neutral by 2021, the 200-year anniversary of independence. And I think these are two important things. One connection that you may not realize is that it was also President Figueres who created ICE, our National Electrical Institute, that handles both electricity and telecommunications. It's become a huge enterprise. And ICE was given the specific mandate to develop hydroelectricity. So we have, from 60 years ago, a mandate to promote renewable energy. Because we don't have any oil, and did not have any oil then, We still do not have any commercial oil, but we do have plenty of renewable resources, and I think that several people have mentioned that the defining characters of Central America with respect to resource endowment is that we lack oil, except for Guatemala, that has a modest production. But the annual oil bill is near $7 billion, so it's very significant. For Costa Rica, near $2 billion alone. We don't have oil, but we do have plenty of other resources like biomass, like solar, like wind, and hydro, primarily. And we have, Costa Rica is the proof that you can develop these resources commercially in an intelligent way if you believe in energy planning. One of the big problems, for example, in the United States, and one of the biggest policy failures was when the CAFE, the fleet standards that were adopted in the 70s, were rolled back in the Reagan era. Well, if those CAFE standards, mileage standards for the fleets of cars, would have been maintained and the cars had maintained the same characteristics, the U.S. would be importing today 5 million barrels less of oil every day. Okay? So that tells you what the cost of a bad policy can be. That you can, but you have to believe in the long term that you have to direct the market towards a more use of renewables, because the reason why renewables have a harder time is that we are not charging the cost of greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels. So we really don't have an even playing field for renewables and for fossil fuels. We have a situation in Central America where firewood is very important in all countries, even in Costa Rica, with 95% electrification. Maybe a third of Costa Ricans still cook with firewood because they have access to it and they prefer it. But in Nicaragua and Honduras and Salvador, Guatemala, most of the rural population still cooks with firewood. So it's important. And as had been said, wind and geothermal have a large proven potential. Johanna mentioned Chavez, and if there's one country where Chavez is playing an incredibly large role, is Nicaragua. Because he provides about 20,000 barrels of oil per day to Nicaragua on credit, and there's a very interesting duality or contradiction, because Venezuela proved this as a state-to-state transaction or treaty, but in Nicaragua is applied as a private transaction, and the aid is privatized through a company called Albaniza that is controlled directly by the Ortega Murillo family. We will come to this a little later, but as I said and has been shown by previous speakers, the development in energy has been uneven, but we have had the benefit of long-term planning. ICE was also the only utility that was not privatized. Only Costa Rica and Uruguay did not privatize their utilities in the 90s. And this was a major debate, and a government almost fell on this issue in Costa Rica. And all countries are actively involved in renewable energy development. Some have easier laws than others. And there is a very interesting public and private combination of investment initiatives and new players like Brazil that is investing directly in a plant in Nicaragua, Tumarin, and China that is thought to be investing in a hydro project in Honduras through Sino Hydro. We estimate the investment opportunities in energy between 10 and $15 billion from here to 2020. Just Costa Rica alone has a very ambitious agenda of $2 to $5 billion, and I will go into this a little bit now. that traditional energy development has been financed with state utilities and international development institutions like IDB. CAVE has played an important role in financing energy development. The World Bank in some countries as well. And this has leveraged other resources from suppliers and from bilateral aid agencies. But really, this is not sufficient for the large amount of needs for energy investment. And the private sector is active in all countries, sometimes in non-conventional ways, because, you know, Costa Rica, for example, has a limitation by law of only 15% private and another 15% BOT-type venture, so 30% total. But, for example, ICE, which is the state utility, is using the fact that Costa Rica has investment grade and has recently issued a $300 million bond issue with Barclays Bank for international customers. And ISA has a very good debt profile, so it can issue debt directly. And because of one of the laws that was passed for CAFTA, ISA was allowed to issue debt directly without having to go through Congress. So that's an important... this is going on now. We're also thinking of issuing green bonds tied to the green portfolio and investments in forestry that Costa Rica has made. Going back quickly to the Chavez situation, Albanisa, this company created to handle the Venezuelan aid, is the largest generator of power in Nicaragua. It has 400 megawatts of thermal power. All the plants that were supposedly given by Venezuela to Nicaragua are under Albanisa today. And they're involved also in geothermal and wind energy projects. So they're really a very important force in Nicaragua. Alba companies last year handled $1 billion, which is very large compared to GDP of Nicaragua of $6 to $7 billion. So this is the size of what we're talking. And they have convinced, among others, the International Monetary Fund that this is all private cooperation. Of course, if Chavez should come to an end, this is going to be a real problem for Nicaragua, because all donors have left Nicaragua, but Chavez has brought in much more money than all the previous donors, about almost $1.5 billion in 4 years. So that's one of the problems that we have to deal with. Although in energy terms, it has helped Nicaragua make the turnaround. They had terrible blackouts, and now the situation is much better. They have an 80-20 matrix, 80% fossil fuels, 20% renewables, which they're trying to revert, like all the rest of the countries. And we were hoping that CEPAC would be a solution. I had the privilege of signing the first donation with Endesa of Spain in 1987. This is how long this has been going on. And, you know, the grid has finally been concluded, or it's almost finished, but we have some serious difficulties because we invested much more on the hardware and have not invested enough in the software. At least, for example, Costa Rica has not yet approved the second protocol, which really defines the market rules. And there's second thoughts in Congress. Several conflicting pieces of legislation. Some congressmen want ISA to continue its role as the only exporting entity, while the treaty really opens it up to all major generators. So there's really a problem of lack of direction and the lack of homogeneity in the thinking of the countries today about CEPAC. And we really have to do a big effort, a political effort, educating Congress. In the case of Costa Rica, this is very critical. Another piece of legislation was introduced this week by the co-ops. So there's, you know, an emergency plan that the government introduced for 4 years. Then there's co-op law. Then there's a CEPAC treaty. And they all have a different underlying philosophy. And so we really have to put our effort there, because the countries have to start paying for these loans that you saw this year. Time has run out. And they don't know where the money is going to come from. You know, originally they said, well, the money is going to come from the electricity trade. But if there is no trade, then the countries are going to have to pay out of their own pocket. And they're going to have to go to the regulators and ask them to pay charges for an interconnection line that, you know, you don't know what the regulators are going to say. So we do have big problems that we have to deal with, and we have to start right away, because these are political problems. It's much easier to solve hardware engineering type problems than to find who the champions are going to be for this. This is sort of sad, because Costa Rica has been one of the champions of this project throughout. And Don Teófilo de la Torre, that Carla knows very well, was the leader of CEPAC for many years. And now he's the leader of ISA again. So he has two hats. But still he has to get this project, this protocol through Congress. And it's not clear when and how this is going to be done. There are problems in Guatemala as well. Political problems, as Hugo has mentioned. So it's not only Costa Rica, and we do need to address these issues urgently. Okay? Thank you very much.
Our final speaker is Dr. Pablo Rodas,
who since 2007 has been the chief economist of the Central American Bank for Economic Integration. And before that, he was the director of the Central America and the World Economy of the 21st Century Project. He has served as a consultant to most major development organizations, and I think we'll look forward to hearing his remarks.
Thank you. Español porque hablo mucho más rápido en español y el tiempo es limitado. Y me disculpo de no usar presentación de PowerPoint, pero hasta hace 2 días yo no estaba en el programa para este panel. Por razones de fuerza mayor, me tocó entrar de bateador emergente y trataré de hacer mi mejor esfuerzo. Realmente la oficina del economista jefe no está involucrada en temas sectoriales, energéticos, ni mucho menos. Nosotros estamos en temas macroeconómicos de la región y en temas de... Nosotros elaboramos las estrategias de país del banco y tampoco pertenecemos al Comité de Crédito del Banco. Entonces, trataré de... Trataré de abordar el tema en tres dimensiones. Primero, solo una rápida presentación de CABEI, porque seguramente algunos de ustedes o muchos de ustedes no conocerán mucho la institución. Segundo, sobre cómo estamos viendo al sector de energía en Centroamérica. Y tercero, qué es lo que el CABEI está haciendo propiamente, el BESI, está haciendo en energía en Centroamérica. Primero, sobre CABEI, es un banco que fue fundado hace 50 años, inicialmente por los 5 países centroamericanos de Guatemala a Costa Rica. Luego se han adherido otros países extrarregionales. De América están, del continente está México, Colombia, Argentina. Una decisión, bueno, luego de Europa está la Unión Europea, de Asia está Taiwán, y las adhesiones más recientes fueron de Panamá, Colombia y Belice como país beneficiario. Se espera que Brasil se incorpore en un futuro cercano y Corea del Sur también se incorpore en un futuro cercano. Entonces, eso es lo que conforman. Pero en el caso de CABEI, el 51% de las acciones pertenecen a los 5 países fundadores. Entonces, es el banco de los centroamericanos. Luego, tiene oficinas en los 5 países de Centroamérica. Eventualmente, seguramente va a tener oficinas en otros países. Los activos totales son de 6.5 mil millones de dólares. Y los préstamos son de 4.8 mil millones de dólares. El CABEI tiene grado de inversión por las 3 calificadoras de riesgo, Moody's, Fitch, Standard & Poor's. Y el banco, ¿cómo se financia? Levanta capital, obviamente, en América Latina, en Estados Unidos, en Europa, en Asia, se ha levantado bastante capital en Asia, que luego se traslada a condiciones favorables para los países centroamericanos. Y bueno, tenemos una estrategia institucional 2010-2014 que marca la ruta del banco para los próximos años. Había una 2004-2009. Yo soy relativamente nuevo en el banco, tengo 5 años de estar en el banco. En esa estrategia se definen 6 áreas de focalización, de las cuales una de las áreas es energía. Aparte, infraestructura productiva, infraestructura social y desarrollo humano. Luego está financiamientos al sistema bancario, líneas intermediadas y finanzas para el desarrollo. Está agricultura y desarrollo rural. Está industria, competitividad y desarrollo urbano. Y en total son 6 áreas de focalización que el banco está enfocando. Y bueno, esto sobre el banco. Paso al segundo tema. ¿Cómo estamos viendo la región? Yo diría, en esencia, quisiera resaltar cinco aspectos. Uno, a nivel de, bueno, lo pudimos ver en la presentación reciente que se hizo, pero vamos desde lo bastante exitoso, el caso de Costa Rica, donde el 93% de la generación en el último año fue energía renovable, hasta el caso de Nicaragua, que sería el más rezagado, donde solo 27% fue energía renovable. Y luego hay unas gradas ahí, pero en general los países están mal ubicados, de El Salvador como el segundo después de Costa Rica, después Panamá, Guatemala y Honduras. Pero sí, a pesar de este gran potencial en hidroeólico, si México tiene lo que se considera el principal sitio del mundo a nivel eólico, que es el Istmo de Tehuantepec, por lo estrecho y porque pegan los vientos de los mares y las montañas, etcétera, Centroamérica en muchas de sus regiones está muy favorecida también para la producción eólica. Entonces, esto a nivel de renovables, solo hice comentarios sobre Nicaragua, pero Nicaragua sí está en un esfuerzo muy radical ahorita por cambiar su matriz energética. Hay una serie de inversiones muy considerables para cambiar su matriz energética y no me cabe ninguna duda que en unos pocos años este 27% del cual estoy hablando va a ser sustancialmente mayor en el caso de Nicaragua. Dos, en el índice de electrificación a nivel de Centroamérica, de nuevo tenemos el caso casi óptimo de Costa Rica, donde más del 99% de los hogares están conectados. Otro ejemplo de éxito, diría yo, que pasó de menos de 30% en 1985 a más de 70% en 15 años o menos, fue Guatemala, y ahorita ya está en más del 80%. Y otros países han tenido, igual, han ido creciendo todos a nivel de electrificación, pero no en la dimensión o el brinco que pegó Guatemala a raíz de los cambios que se hicieron en el sector de energía hace algunos años. Luego, el tercero es el tema del crecimiento de la demanda de energía. Uno podría decir que en los últimos años hay 2 fases. Una es antes del 2006 o hasta 2006 y otra de 2006 para acá. Es decir, no es a partir de la crisis, porque la crisis sabemos que es 2008, 2009, más con impacto en Centroamérica es 2009, sino que curiosamente, entonces, antes de o hasta 2006 estaba creciendo más o menos la demanda centroamericana entre un 4 o 5% por año. Y luego ya ha bajado y algunos años ha crecido 3, 2%, 1%, y hay asimetrías entre los países. Entonces tenemos un país como Panamá que está creciendo bastante, mientras que Guatemala quizás ha sido el país que ha tenido menos crecimiento en su demanda de energía. Luego, a nivel de eficiencia, hay diferentes parámetros de eficiencia, pero si tomáramos la pérdida en transmisión y distribución, de nuevo Costa Rica sería el caso más óptimo, donde es cerca del 10% lo que se pierde. El Salvador, Guatemala y principalmente Panamá han tenido reducciones muy fuertes, ya están llegando a niveles del 12, 11, 13% y acercándose a Costa Rica. Los casos más ineficientes a nivel de su red de transmisión son Honduras y Nicaragua, donde se desperdicia más del 20% de la energía. Y finalmente, a nivel de tarifas, un tema que había sido mencionado antes, obviamente hay ineficiencias, hay subsidios, quizás los países que tienen las ineficiencias más grandes a nivel tarifario y que no han acomodado mucho precio en mercado, es el caso de Honduras y Panamá, pero bueno, Panamá se puede dar ese lujo, Honduras no tanto. Y Costa Rica también tiene tarifas en algunos casos, si uno mira por el desglose de hogares, comercial, industrial, etcétera, uno puede ver, pero obviamente en el caso de Honduras es una energía más barata, es energía hídrica en su gran medida, versus el caso de los países centroamericanos o de otros países centroamericanos que dependen mucho de una energía más cara, como la térmica. Entonces, así es como estamos viendo un poco la región. Agradecemos sobremanera a CEPAL, que produce unos informes fabulosos a nivel de energía desde México. Y realmente nosotros no somos generadores primarios de información, descansamos mucho a nivel macro de todo lo que produce CEMCA, a nivel de indicadores sociales y energía, lo que produce CEPAL, el estado de la región. Entonces, somos consumidores muy, muy altos de información. Luego, el tercer tema, el tema de KBI, ya con esto iría cerrando. ¿Qué es lo que KBI ha hecho? De 2008 para acá, solo para hablar de los años más recientes, KBI ha aprobado, permítanme, 1.148 millones de dólares para energía. En total son 28 proyectos, 16 de ellos para sector público, 12 de ellos para sector privado. Pero al decir sector público, estamos hablando también de instituciones como CEL en Salvador, estamos hablando como ICE en el caso de Costa Rica, que es una deuda pública no soberana. Y en el caso privado, usualmente el banco como va, son con préstamos cofinanciados, sindicados con otras instituciones, usualmente a plazos de 12 años. Y por mencionar algunos de los proyectos de 2008 para la fecha, van desde proyectos relativamente pequeños, por ejemplo hay dos de CIPAC, ambos de 4.5 millones de dólares, otro de 5.4 millones de dólares para Cartago en Costa Rica, hasta proyectos de 57.5 millones en el caso de Expansión Central Hidroeléctrica 5 de Noviembre en El Salvador, 60 millones para el proyecto eólico de Cerro de Ura en Honduras, 66.5 millones para, esta es una térmica, en Guatemala, luego el 75 millones para un programa nacional de electrificación sostenible y energía renovable, en el caso de Nicaragua, 80 millones para la hidroeléctrica Palomino en Panamá, en República Dominicana, perdón, y un proyecto muy grande, bueno, hay otro de 140 millones para Costa Rica, de ampliación del ICE, de ampliación de su hidroeléctrica Cachi, y el más grande es 258 millones de dólares que se aprobó este año, para la gran hidroeléctrica fantasma de Nicaragua. Como digo, Nicaragua está en ese momento en grandes inversiones que van a cambiar radicalmente su matriz energética. Pero cerrando ya sobre el tema de KBI, solo mencionar que, por ejemplo, en 2008 el banco, bueno, de 2008 para acá el banco ha aprobado más de 1.000 millones de dólares anuales. Y de esos, por ejemplo, en 2008, 22.8% fueron para energía. En el 2009, sí hubo poco, fue 4.7%. En 2010 fue 30.3%. En 2011 fue 33.1%. Y en el POA contemplado, para 2012 se está contemplando 33.8% del total de aprobaciones para energía. Luego, solo mencionar que en total, a nivel histórico, si a uno ya se va bastante más para atrás de las aprobaciones del banco, 32% han sido para el sector privado, 68% para el sector público, pero yo diría que esta relación está cambiando y está favoreciendo más las inversiones privadas debido a estas necesidades de alianzas público-privadas y la dificultad de algunos gobiernos a nivel de deuda. Luego, el banco tiene una estrategia de energía que fue aprobada en 2008 y finalmente decir que, bueno, nosotros tenemos el banco ha aprobado 38% para hidro a nivel histórico, 1% entre biomasa y solar, 8% geotérmica, 7% eólico, 23% ha sido térmico, distribución 8% y transmisiones 15%. Y cierro diciendo lo siguiente. Sí, termino justo. Termino diciendo lo siguiente. El banco obviamente quiere aprobar lo más posible de energía renovable que se pueda, pero el banco entonces tiene su estrategia institucional, pero siempre, y esto porque a nosotros nos toca a nivel de la oficina del economista jefe, las estrategias de país es el único momento del banco que sale un momento del banco para buscar el visto bueno de los gobiernos. Y todos los demás siguen sencillamente el proceso del comité correspondiente y después el board del banco. En este caso buscamos el visto bueno porque obviamente no vamos alineados con los principios de París, queremos apegarnos al Plan Nacional de Desarrollo del país. Entonces es la estrategia del banco en base a su expertise, en base a lo que el banco puede hacer, pero queriendo compatibilizar con las demandas del país. Entonces, ha habido demandas de proyectos térmicos en la región centroamericana, es decir, los gobiernos a veces tienen la urgencia de necesitan energía y han sido los planteamientos también al banco. Y en algunos casos también hay que reconocer el caso de Costa Rica, más bien su problema es que está demasiado hacia lo hídrico, hacia lo renovable, y si viene la niña entonces se ve con dificultades, con las sequías, y tiene la necesidad de tener un potencial térmico que logre compensar esas mermas en tiempos de sequía. Entonces, este es un balance delicado que el banco tiene que manejar. El énfasis claramente es hacia energía renovable, pero reconociendo de que hay demandas en energía térmica. Obviamente, no vamos, como el caso de China, que se sabe que a nivel de, ya con eso cierro, solo China consume más carbón que toda Norteamérica, Europa juntos, y que cada semana se colocan dos plantas de carbón nuevas en China. Es decir, lógicamente, en el caso de Centroamérica, no estamos hablando ni por asomo de estas dimensiones, pero el banco tiene que compatibilizar estos dos elementos, enfatizando el tema de energía renovable. Gracias.
Well, I want to thank all three of our panelists for both informative, but I think also very forthcoming a discussion of some of the opportunities as well as some of the difficulties in effecting Central American energy integration. If I may just exercise the power of the chair first to ask a question. In many parts of the emerging market world, we see energy demand going up very strongly, but oftentimes because of skewed pricing signals either given to producers, probably less the case in Central America, or end-use consumers. And I was wondering if any of you think that is a problem, that if we went to more complete unregulated pricing, whether we could reduce the demand and hence the need to build some electric facilities, for example, as fast as we might with unfettered demand. Does anybody want to take that?
I think that the issue of pricing and demand is important. There are some small subsidies, for example, in Costa Rica to the residential sector. But in general, Central America does not have very highly subsidized energy prices. Energy is regulated as a public utility in most countries. So the issue of pricing is important because you do need to send the right signals, but you also need to focus more specifically on energy efficiency. For example, in the Dominican Republic, if we take the example, it's almost the flip side of Costa Rica. They have 90% thermal generation in their electric grid. And they also have still incandescent public lights. And the way in which they save money is that they turn off the lights at night of the public system. So in Costa Rica, we have a challenge. We have sodium lights, but now we have to go to LEDs. We have opportunities in saving in electric motors, in air conditioning, in a few others that we have to target, and we have to reduce that demand. But generally, utilities have been planning at a much higher demand than will be realized. ESA was planning at 6-7%. Now we're going more like to 5. I think that we really have to go into a mode of high prices, rational energy use, promoting energy efficiency, and trying to stay on a renewable course. Because the challenge in Central America, as Pablo was saying, both Guatemala and El Salvador are thinking of expanding with coal, because they don't. That's the least cost option, but they're not including the cost of the carbon emissions.
Well, this would not be the building that we'd want to extol as the most energy efficient either. Do any of the panelists want to ask each other a question before we go to the audience on the basis of the remarks?
Tal vez solo sobre el tema de precios, uno sí esperaría que hubiera una... Es decir, cuando uno mira las tarifas, todavía se sorprende un poco de los niveles, cuando uno va haciendo el desglose, ya mencionaba yo el caso de Honduras o Panamá, pero dada la dependencia que muchos países todavía tienen de energía térmica, que es mucho más costosa, uno creería en un momento determinado que deberían estar con una tarifa más elevada, y lamentablemente no es así. Y eso explica, por ejemplo, en el caso de Honduras, muchos de los problemas de la ENE, aparte de ineficiencia que ha habido y de corrupción que ha habido en el pasado, pero también existe un mal pliego tarifario que no es el más ajustado para en base al costo de producción que están generando.
I don't want to go into the pricing in detail, but one point that happens in many parts of Central America is that a lot of the electricity is stolen in urban areas, and that also has an impact on pricing, because if you're getting lines that are not belonging to you and using that, it also skews the way energy is priced, and it keeps it high rather than low. And the challenge is really the need to create subsidies as part of these social packages which help people get energy, at a rate which allows them to live a normal, decent life. And it's more tied to poverty reduction strategies in certain areas which haven't been well worked out in all countries. But I did have a question, and it related to perhaps the gentleman from Cabe can talk to us about it. The investments in renewable energy, mainly aeolic, the wind energy, and the solar arrays which are starting, how do you look at them in comparison, for example, to someone wanting to start a thermal plant? I mean, do you have some kinds of priorities within the bank as to your what you want to fund? Because you obviously need capital, and it's going to have to come from somewhere. So is there a policy towards this renewable portfolio?
Yes. Bueno, tal vez solo antes mencionar que este año, bueno, hemos aprobado varias estrategias de país, el board del banco ha aprobado varias estrategias de país, algo que olvidaba mencionar, y justo en la de República Dominicana que se aprobó este año, en la de Costa Rica que se aprobó este año, en la de El Salvador que se aprobó este año, en las tres estas que menciono iba el tema de energía como una área de la actualización importante. El caso de República Dominicana quizás el más dramático y relacionado con lo que mencionaba, De robo de energía. Es decir, llega un punto en el cual en Dominicana hay sectores que consideran la electricidad como que fuera un bien público o gratuito, como el aire, entonces sienten que no tienen el por qué pagar por ese servicio. Entonces ha sido muy arduo para los diferentes gobiernos tratar de revertir esta idiosincrasia cultural. Luego, solo en el caso de Belice, que debido a la limitación de recursos, porque lo que el banco puede prestar a un país va en multiplicación al capital o el aporte que el país ha dado. Entonces, como había menos posibilidad o el monto es menor en el caso de Belice, lo que se le puede llegar a prestar, ahí no se incluyó el tema de energía, aunque no se descarta que en un momento determinado ahí se privilegiaron otros sectores como carreteras. Luego, sobre este tema, francamente no tengo una respuesta así precisa. Como digo, yo no estoy en el análisis de los dictámenes del banco. Yo tendría que consultar esto con las personas que miran estos temas. Pero sí, lo que sí diría es de que ellos tienen claro de que en la estrategia institucional del banco, el tema de energía renovable es de mucha importancia. Entonces, saben que hay un sesgo, si queremos llamarlo así, un sesgo pro, a favor de privilegiar los proyectos de energía renovable. Y algo tal vez interesante que ayuda a complementar, y sobre esto sí, porque estuve en los orígenes, aunque después todo este tema se pasó a la oficina de evaluación, pero inicialmente esto dependió de mi oficina hasta el año pasado. Nosotros generamos dos sistemas de impacto en el desarrollo, y uno es un índice BESIL, así le llamamos, donde es un índice que va de 0 a 500 puntos, es una adaptación para Centroamérica y para el BESI del índice GPR que usa la DEC de Alemania y que ha replicado cerca de 10 bancos de desarrollo de Europa que prestan en países del tercer mundo. Y nosotros, obviamente, se hizo toda una adaptación, ellos es para el sector privado, nosotros tuvimos que replantear todo eso porque el banco, cerca de 70% de la cartera es sector público en total y 30% sector privado. Entonces, este es un índice que incluye una serie de indicadores cuantitativos y cualitativos, y de los cuales uno de ellos, por ejemplo, es en tema ambiental. Entonces, ahí obviamente un proyecto renovable recibe más puntos que un proyecto no renovable. Y esto es tomado en cuenta por el comité de crédito. No llega al punto de prohibir una operación, pero sí se advierte al comité de crédito de que esta operación, bueno, no puntea tan bien a nivel de impacto en el desarrollo. Y obviamente una hidro, una eólica va a puntear mucho mejor que una térmica.
Y luego, el otro sistema que el banco tiene también, y creo que somos el único banco con la KFW que tenemos un sistema cuantitativo para medir esto a nivel mundial, es tenemos una matriz para medir el impacto en los ODM, en los Objetivos de Desarrollo del Milenio, de todas las operaciones del banco. Y ya se elaboraron el informe 2009-2010. Y en este caso, realmente quien tuvo la idea fue la KFW. Nosotros no nos pareció la metodología de la KFW por diferentes razones. Entonces, con apoyo del PNUD, generamos una nueva metodología. Y ya los informes 2009-2010, el banco entonces en este momento sabe y tiene mapeado todas sus operaciones y sabe a qué Objetivos de Desarrollo del Milenio le estamos apuntando y a cuáles no. Y sabemos a través de qué mecanismo le estamos apuntando al primero, que es reducción de pobreza, o le estamos apuntando al tercero, que es tema de género, o le estamos apuntando al séptimo, que tiene que ver con temas ambientales, etcétera. Y sabemos los canales. Y de esa manera logramos nosotros ya, y con esto concluyo, ya de esa manera logramos nosotros, incluso ex ante, saber más o menos el tipo de impacto que posteriormente va a tener. De nuevo, esto es orientativo, eso no es... si un gobierno siente que tiene la necesidad extrema de una carbonera, por ejemplo, y justifica, y hace el requerimiento muy puntual al banco, dado que el banco está alineado con las demandas de los países, entonces, lógicamente, el banco analiza estas solicitudes. El banco prefiere financiar renovable, pero tiene que compatibilizar su deseo con la realidad diaria de hacer política económica y social en Centroamérica.
Why don't we go to the floor, Kevin?
Okay, thanks so much. Thank you all for very interesting presentations. I guess there are two ways in which one can frame the future of renewable energy in Central America. I mean, one way to see it is, whether the countries are willing to change their energy matrix for their own internal purposes, so as to have, more sustainability or whatever it is. But the other way is to see it as a catalyzer for economic development. Mm-hmm. And whether the region is willing to become what Johanna mentioned, a powerhouse in terms of renewable energy. Mm-hmm. And my question is to all the panelists is whether you get the sense that the governments in the region and also, multilateral financial institutions are perceiving this potential in terms of the latter way that I pose rather than the former, in terms of how the development of renewable energies can be a catalyzer of economic development and truly one of the anchors of Central American development in the global economy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want us to answer or do you want to?
No, go ahead. We've got some time. Why don't you?
Well, I know Alvaro probably has his point, mm-hmm. but I think your question is the most important way to look at it. And you can look at this as just another problem of generating energy because you have to survive, or you can look at this as a way to stimulate both private and public partnerships in investing in the future. And it seems to me one of the biggest challenges in Central America, for example, is employment. And the energy sector is a major employer in the renewable area. And we need a whole cadre of people who can work in the energy sector. And that it hasn't been posed as part of the bigger social investment policy, even though I think the numbers that just came out of CEPAL and the 2011 Poverty Reduction Index shows a great deal of progress. Nobody frames the energy question in terms of jobs, in terms of investment, in terms of the future. Now, even in education, if you don't have energy, you don't have kids who can read by school lights, even in the rural parts of many of these countries. And yet you don't hear that discussion going. I just want to put a plug in because a couple of years ago we started something called the Latin American and Caribbean Council for Renewable Energy. And we've really had a tough time getting it off the ground because our goal was to bring the private sector and the people who were involved in technologies to the regions. And in some areas, it's taken off in Colombia, it's taken off in the Southern Cone. There are opportunities where I think you can begin to bring people who are going to invest, but also are going to bring jobs to these areas, and also provide projects that look at the region as a social opportunity. Now, one other point, and I'm sure Alvaro knows this as well, is that there is a deficit of people who have engineering skills and education skills to even be linemen, for example, who understand how, I mean, I think there's a whole generation of people who won't know how to work. You know, you put in SEAPOC, but what's your educational component? People have to maintain those lines, and they have to maintain them every day. So we don't take advantage of the collateral opportunities that come with energy, and I think that's a narrative that the politicians have to change. And I think there's an opportunity because it's related to the broader dimensions of the security agenda in the region, because if the youth have jobs, the reduction of crime goes down, and I think it should be put into an integrated package. But that's just one person's opinion.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add that?
Yes. No, I think that Costa Rica very much looks at it as an opportunity, and as the most dynamic, one of the most dynamic sectors in the economy, clearly. The problem is that, investment is limited in all countries. Public investment is limited by the fiscal crisis. I mean, we are happy that Central America is a region of complete stability or compared to Europe, you know, at the moment. But there are limitations, and Central America is not, although, you know, we do have the infrastructure, it's not really thinking of itself as a region so much anymore. Mm-hmm. We see, you know, Panama and maybe Costa Rica on one side. Nicaragua is going on a completely different direction. El Salvador and Honduras, you know, have, and Guatemala are more integrated but have their own problems. So we really have to make an effort to promote this regional vision and to invest in education. You know, I mean, if there's one small criticism we can do to CIUPAC is that they have underinvested in education and information and communications. Because that is becoming the roadblock. Mm-hmm. Costa Rica has a huge opportunity for investment in energy. There's thousands of projects, and we have not yet defined what model we want to use. Okay? We have not yet defined if we want narrow gauge railroad or wide gauge railroad. You know, a number of things that appear almost ridiculous. But those are the real obstacles we have. And each country has their own different obstacles. You know, but the lack of resources is not a major constraint, except, you know, in countries like El Salvador that really doesn't have any more hydro to use. But I think there's a lot of potential for energy to become a catalyst for development in Central America. And we have to start seeing it more than way, rather than something that we have to do because somebody's forcing us to do it from the outside.
Sí, pero creo que el punto es muy relevante y solo amplifico con el siguiente caso de hasta hace unos años el ejecutivo que revisaba los dictámenes en el banco, que elaboraba los dictámenes, por ejemplo, básicamente veía indicadores financieros. Ahora que tenemos esta IDESI, entonces ya le pregunta, tiene que preguntar al solicitante del crédito una serie de preguntas de desarrollo, de impacto en el desarrollo. Y ejemplifico con el tema de energía. Si, realmente lo que encontramos es que la generación de energía no es muy generadora de empleo directo. Ni siquiera en la fase de construcción, sí, por supuesto. Pero una vez terminada la fase de construcción, el empleo permanente es muy bajo. Sea hidro, sea térmica, sea lo que sea. Y digo eso porque se preguntaba a los solicitantes exactamente cuánto empleo temporal, cuánto empleo permanente pensaban generar. Lo que sí es que el impacto indirecto, obviamente energía, incide sobre todos los sectores, aumenta la capacidad productiva. Entonces ahí ese impacto indirecto a nivel de empleo es más difuso, pero lógicamente se estima que es mucho más que es mucho mayor. Y luego, en el caso, por ejemplo, de ODM, solo explico un poquito cómo funciona el sistema. Es, lógicamente, impacta sobre el ODM-1 porque genera empleo, contribuye a la reducción de la pobreza, que es una generación de empleo, es una de las vías, una de las metas a través de las cuales se puede contrarrestar la pobreza. Pero también el mismo PNUD nos dijo a nosotros, miren, no, esto incide sobre el, aunque obviamente se le da una ponderación menor porque no es una inversión directa en el tema, pero incide sobre los indicadores de salud y sobre los indicadores de educación. ¿Por qué razón? Porque obviamente al haber electricidad, centros de salud, sí, hospitales tienen provisión eléctrica, se presta un mejor servicio,
Educación, bueno, los niños pueden estudiar en la noche, en la tarde, uh-huh. y obviamente incide, aunque tal vez no tanto como directamente una inversión directa en educación, pero de manera indirecta fluye hacia el tema de impacto en desarrollo. Entonces, así es un poquito como opera este IBESI y la matriz de ODM que tenemos en el banco.
I think we have a question here, gentlemen.
Maybe it's a comment. I don't know yet, right? No, Central America sits among giants of energy giants, and I'm not talking only about Venezuela, but also Mexico, the seventh largest exporter in the world. Colombia is the fourth largest exporter of coal, and it's got the largest mm-hmm. reserves of coal in Latin America, and of course the U.S. And yet, you know, Central America is highly dependent of imported oil. You know, the oil bill, as Alvaro said, was $7 billion. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you know, we're kind of dismissive of Petrocaribe. We will not last. But it's solving real problems in the region. It's a mechanism that, when I went to evaluate the earthquake in Haiti, I discovered that Venezuela was the largest donor in Haiti. Right. And overnight, they canceled, $400 million in debt. You go to the Dominican Republic, and the friends that Petrocaribe has generated in the ministries of finance, mm-hmm. because they're solving real balance of payments problems. So it is paradoxical that a region that sits among giants, energy giants, does not have a portfolio of tools. Mm-hmm. And building on Johanna's comments, how we can generate more interest in the U.S., I'm not talking in abstract, in the U.S. For greater energy cooperation. And we're talking about, private sector investment projects, technical capacity, but also specific tools such as those used to exist in the Pacto de San Jose well before. So I think it's an issue. There's an issue there. We might not like Petrocaribe. We tend to do a cartoon about it, but you talk to ministers of finance and getting long-term concessional finance for half of your energy bill.
That's important.
It's an important issue, and we can dismiss it. We can say we will not last. But if you are sitting in a government that lasts 4 years, and you get your energy finance, long-term finance, 1%
for 40 years.
For basically, the problem is, so we ought to think differently, and I think I want to build on Johanna's comment that we ought to raise more attention here in the U.S. I'm following on her presentation, which I enjoyed tremendously. Yeah, I think we might need a good matchmaker for those seven brothers and seven brides, and we ought to think how to enhance technical energy cooperation in the region. I wonder if you could have more comments on that.
I think that will generate some comments, but may I urge quick answers and quick further questions so we get some more questions in the room. Anybody want to respond?
Go ahead.
All right, go ahead. Go ahead.
My question is what role China can play in this potential building.
Okay, why don't we take a couple more questions and then we'll lump them together.
There's one there. Go ahead.
Quisiera hacerle una pregunta al representante del BCE. Es si ustedes han considerado promover facilidades para establecer una cultura de ahorro energético, como el doctor Umaña lo mencionaba, tenemos que ir acompañando esto con eficiencia energética. Si hay algo de eso contemplado dentro del banco.
Okay, what? Do we have any more? All right, why don't we respond to those three and whoever would like to.
Let me start with the Petrocaribe because I absolutely share your concern that this did lower the energy bill a great deal. There was also a lot of games played with that money in different countries We know that even though the bill for the government's energy needs were reduced on the street, the public did not feel the impact of Petrocaribe, which is why there has been a turning of attitude. I've seen this in many countries that I've traveled in the region, both in the Caribbean, who benefited it by as well. And often Petrocaribe did not make deliveries, even though they said they were going to do it. I worked in Haiti, and many times, even before the earthquake, they did not meet their delivery needs. Plus, it's a long-term debt. But I think you're right that we should be looking forward to matchmakers who can bring in both the private sector and also address these collateral needs of energy education, which go from efficiency issues that Alvaro talked about to issues of education and how you improve these things. The technology is there. It is not something that we don't have. But one of the big deficits, in not only in Central America but the rest of Latin America, is lack of innovation, lack of filing of patents. We can go through the list of all the things that I think there is capacity, but not a lot of effort to build on the capacity in a regional basis. So I think the challenge moving forward is, assuming that oil prices are not going down, why you are not developing these rich resources. And geothermal is one. I mean, Central America sits the ring of fire of volcanic energy. Why is this not being built? I mean, Iceland has offered to come in. They've also done some work in Nicaragua, but you have to be able to tap this and have an organization that will do that, and unfortunately, nobody's there. Just to make one comment on China, which China? Because Taiwan is investing in Honduras as well. I'm sorry to bring that up, but the two China, there still is. I was being flippant when I said that, because there is a big Taiwanese investment going on in Honduras right now on a dam. But I think the challenge with China's investment, and I've heard this, I was just in Brazil, is that when China invests, it also wants to bring its own labor force.
Yes.
And I think there's been a really backlash of this policy going on from the Caribbean, where they offered to build a stadium, but with their own label, to the energy sector. And so I believe that many countries are thinking twice about the generosity of the Chinese in comparison to the need to bring in their own public, their own unions, their own people. And I think that the investments will continue because they have the money, but there will be other sources of resources as well with better terms. Mm-hmm. And Brazil will be one of those, as well as Colombia.
Petrocaribe, totalmente de acuerdo con Hugo. Si Venezuela desea financiar a 30 años plazo, 2% de tasa de interés, solo pagando una parte, el resto con este financiamiento, yo creo que cualquier gobierno sería miope de no tomar una oportunidad de esta, que mucha falta le hace. Pero definitivamente Petrocaribe ha jugado un rol importante, principalmente República Dominicana, en Nicaragua también, pero también en otros países de Centroamérica. Dos, sobre los gigantes. Yo sí diría, en el caso de México, es un gigante con pies de barro, ya a nivel energético. Y el 21% de su energía renovable, se espera que al final del periodo de Calderón sea el 26% renovable. La aspiración, están muy agresivos, pero aún así hay una serie de grandes proyectos renovables. Pero realmente ellos ya sus reservas petroleras vienen en declive. Y por eso fue la famosa cancelación de la refinería, donde Centroamérica se estuvo peleando, Guatemala, Salvador, todos se peleaban, Panamá, por querer tener la refinería, la que jamás llegó. Porque al final los mexicanos se dieron cuenta que no tenían la capacidad de proveer de este petróleo a los países centroamericanos. Tres, Colombia sí definitivamente sería un socio muy importante, tiene un gran potencial energético. Y luego la pregunta sobre eficiencia. Definitivamente hay mucho rol. Estaba revisando ahorita los precios del banco, no veo de estos últimos algo en tema de eficiencia. Ahí tiene que ser más en coordinación con los gobiernos. Se sabe en el nivel mundial de que se estima que cerca de un 20% de reducción se puede lograr fácilmente con medidas relativamente sencillas a nivel de eficiencia, ya el siguiente 20% a nivel mundial, y obviamente mucho de esto aplicaría para Centroamérica, ya sería mucho más arduo, pero una primera senda sí se logra a través de medidas como las que México está implantando. Luego, pero solo también ahí no olvidar lo que Jevons, la paradoja de Jevons que se menciona en energía, donde dice, no creamos que en un momento determinado por ahorrar más, vamos a consumir menos. Es decir, está demostrado históricamente de que ahorrar más al final nos lleva a consumir más. Entonces, no es solamente, obviamente, el tema de eficiencia, no estoy diciendo con esto que no sea relevante, pero lo que él encontró a final del siglo XIX fue esta paradoja, y por eso lleva su nombre. Luego, los dos últimos temas, geotérmico, definitivamente es muy importante, Centroamérica tiene un gran potencial, solo no brinquemos demasiado Ya hay hallazgos científicos recientes que relacionan, como yo mencionaba en mi discurso inaugural, cierta mayor propensión a terremotos o a sismos, más que terremotos, pero con la probabilidad con el tema geotérmico. Entonces, Centroamérica, que ha tenido terremotos devastadores en Guatemala, en Salvador, en Costa Rica, en Nicaragua, solo Honduras, prácticamente, que por no tener zona volcánica, no ha sido propenso. Y estamos en esta falla también del Caribe. Entonces, lógicamente tenemos un gran potencial, pero hay que analizarlo con mucho cuidado. Ya hay países, obviamente los países más avanzados como Suiza, donde ya han llegado a la cancelación incluso de proyectos geotérmicos para evitar esta propensión al tema sísmico. Y finalmente, sobre el caso de China, China no va a entrar en el sector eléctrico en Centroamérica. Yo no lo vería realistamente en mediano plazo. China desea alimentos, desea soya, etcétera, y desea minerales. Entonces, en esto está invirtiendo fuerte. Es decir, ellos necesitan para su consumo doméstico. Entonces, energía eléctrica en Centroamérica para proveer, no les... No veo a China en esta ecuación, aunque no descartaría totalmente. Es decir, el caso de Costa Rica, ellos ya entraron, ya hay... bueno, de hecho, el Estadio Nacional fue construido por los chinos, según entiendo. Y entonces, entiendo que están incursionando en otros sectores. No lo descartaría totalmente, pero no veo a China como un gran jugador a nivel del sector eléctrico en Centroamérica, al menos en el corto y mediano plazo.
Okay. Yes. Petrocaribe, I think it's very serious. It's a very good program for the countries that have it. And my comments were only related to the way the money is being used in Nicaragua. That's not the norm. But other countries have more transparent ways to use it. Nicaragua is just privatizing it, you know, at the presidential level. And this is something that, it's the wealth of the Venezuelan people that is being squandered. So it's an important issue that will rise as a political issue in the future. But the Petrocaribe takes the place of the Convenio San Jose that was started in 1980, and it was because of the way that the relation between Mexico and Venezuela deteriorated that, you know, there was no longer possible for them to continue, and Chavez say, I go at it alone. The biggest beneficiary is Cuba, 100,000 barrels a day. Let's not forget about that. This is a matter of life and death. For Cuba, but so is for Nicaragua now. Nicaragua has become absolutely dependent on Venezuelan aid, in the last 4 years. Much more important than all development banks put together, what they're getting from Petrocaribe and from the ALBA partnership. I do think that the Chinese have a role to play. I mean, they are playing it in Honduras right now in Proyecto Patuque Tres, that they are negotiating with the government. And it is true that they provide investment, but they want to do the construction too. That is the model that they are going with. I was in a conversation with President Lobo about this project. I don't think that they have come to an agreement yet, but they're seriously thinking about going in. It's a 100-megawatt project.
Wow.
And that would be their first. And also very interesting, they do not want Honduras to break relations with Taiwan. For them, that is not an issue anymore. I think Costa Rica was expensive enough for them. But, in Costa Rica, the minister will appreciate this. Now, after they built the stadium, and it's a beautiful stadium, now we have a new solution to all our problems. And you talk to any taxi driver about La Platina or anything else, they say, we should just hire the Chinese, Any problem we have, that is the new solution.
I would just like to remind people, and this will not please any clean energy supporters in the room, but despite Mr. Chavez's best efforts to screw up the Venezuelan oil sector, they're still sitting on the Orinoco, which is absolutely staggering in size. So there is at least the prospect down the road that Venezuela might reemerge as a much more significant player even than it is today.
Mm-hmm. I think no one disputes the potential
of the Orinoco, and I mean also that goes all into Colombia too, which
right.
because of the conflict is now only being explored, and Brazil's potential in 8 years. I mean, the energy access has shifted to the Western Hemisphere in the second decade of the 21st century, and I think that will be positive for Central America as well, because it will have a resource base that will not be only dependent on oil from the Middle East, which is another factor, but that's another session, I think.
We have time, I think, for a couple more questions.
Thank you very much. Two comments. On the ethanol tariff, you know, which certainly is going to phase out at the end of the year, the CBI Ethanol Industry Group, together with the embassies of El Salvador, Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, and Costa Rica, which are the four CBI countries that have ethanol production, have been carrying out a very, very intense lobbying effort in Congress, basically to get a five-year extension. Very happy to announce that Congressman Charlie Rangel has basically offered to sponsor a bill, so he's sponsoring a bill for the extension. And we have the support of some important members of Congress, like Congressman Engel, Congressman Burton, Congressman Payne. They have just sent a dear colleague letter, and apparently they have the support of Senators Grassley and Thune. So we hope that we will get the extension. The problem is that there's no legislative vehicle this year to get the extension for this year. But, you know, we're going to carry out this lobbying effort, and we hope that by next year we will be able to find a vehicle to get the extension. And truly so, you know, why would the U.S. give up this concession to Brazil without anything in it? You know, that's something that really the United States has to ask itself. Now, my other comment is the experience of public-private partnerships, you know, especially in the case of Costa Rica, has not been very promising. And, you know, the Vice Minister mentioned that we do need a lot of capacity on this area. And my question is, you know, or my comment is, we have to be very careful on sponsoring this kind of partnerships in the energy sector, and we have to make sure that we bring on board the environmental groups, because in the case of Costa Rica, you know, they have been, I guess, key on stopping or hindering, you know, some of these projects.
Anybody else have a question we can bundle? Yes.
Nobody mentioned gas.
And it's everybody's so talking about gas, is so excited about the possibility to get gas. Mexico has huge gas reserves, and I was wondering if you could give us some comments on the on mentioned bride.
I think that gas has a huge role to play. It's going to be the transition fuel from oil to cleaner, hopefully renewable sources. We do have a lot of opportunities to start utilizing gas more intensely. Here in the U.S., you know, this famous investor, oil man T-Bone Pickens, is proposing that the entire transport fleet of the United States should be converted to natural gas, that we should start producing trucks that run on natural gas. Well, in Central America, we have to do the retrofit, but there is a huge potential for transport, for cargo transport, for taxis, for individual vehicles, and for cooking, to reduce the peak loads force you to invest more. So there's a whole host of opportunities that we have for gas, and we should start including it more actively in the planning in Central America.
There are some people who also believe that one of the new big shale gas plays in the U.S. and South Texas, the Eagle Ford, a lot of people believe that that extends into Mexico. And if true, some of the numbers people are banding about are huge. So that would be a boon not only for Mexico, but potentially for Central America. It's also the case that with all the shale gas that appears to be in the United States, that that we actually have a study underway right now looking at the prospect for U.S. become a major gas exporter. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people think, apart from the LNG exports, a lot of people are talking about that we might be able to export up to another BCF a day to Mexico, assuming Mexico wants it. That's always problematic in our relations with Mexico in the energy sector. Mm-hmm. But it does offer a tremendous possibilities.
Might be a game changer.
Could be a game changer. Mm-hmm. I think it's a game changer. Personally, I think it's a game changer worldwide.
Right. Mm-hmm. But, no, lógicamente tiene potencial. De hecho, hace 2-3 años hablaba bastante, o 3-4 años, en el caso de Salvador. Debido al desarrollo del puerto de Cotuco, se hablaba de una regasificadora que iba a traer gas desde Perú, si mal no recuerdo. Pero luego, como ese proyecto quedó un poco y se volvió a solvar el puerto, etcétera, y está básicamente que parado el puerto de Cotuco, entonces entiendo que eso se desestimó y no va a arrancar seguramente, sino, o si se vuelve a plantear hasta dentro de algunos años. Pero sí, lógicamente, la posibilidad para Centroamérica sería importante de importar y generar con gas.
I think one of our speakers may have to leave. We're just waiting for Assistant Secretary Fernandez to get here. So if anybody else has any additional questions, we can keep it going until his arrival. Or comments? Yes, sir.
No. We need to cut it.
Right? Oh, you ready? All right, let's take one. Can we take one question? Quick question and quick answer. Go ahead, sir.
Shall I go ahead?
Yeah.
Okay. By all accounts, growth in sustainable forms of renewable energy are tied to incentives such as, you know, production-based incentives or quota-type incentives. So what are the barriers and the future, do you think, for these type of incentives to take place in Central American countries?
Can I just answer that quickly? I mean, there's a real incentive to promote biomass energy because of the U.S. Energy Security Act, which is requiring a blending of ethanol, and certainly that incentive should have produced more, actually, in the way of ethanol production in Central America, and it didn't because the demand is going to be here. But I think part of incentives has to do with getting your regulatory house in order. And until that's in order, even though the laws that have been passed in the countries which have renewable energy laws have tremendous tax incentives for the private sector, it's not consistent, and that's part of the challenge right now. I'm sure other people have.
Diría que definitivamente.
Very quickly.
Yes.
The secretary is here.
Bueno, definitivamente incentivos son importantes. Faltan en algunos países de Centroamérica. En el caso de Guatemala, por ejemplo, por citar un caso, se han suprimido incentivos fiscales, pero hay como un reconocimiento de que para energía renovable debería de mantenerse. Y eso, esencialmente, tenía algo más que decir, pero por razón de tiempo. Gracias.
Let's thank the panel for an excellent presentation.